Oh, yeah, that's right, everybody. Merry Christmas. This is Michael Rice, and you're listening to Opera Now, the Opera Podcast. Happy, this is our official Christmas show, the 23rd, Christmas Eve, Eve. And we were going to maybe do a Hanukkah show, but we decided not to. Ethan wouldn't do it. He was ashamed because he's a Buddhist now.
I hate you.
And he's ashamed of his people. And he,
I hate you so much.
Oh, it was really painful to watch.
I love the Jews. I am a Jew.
That's true, you are. Well, let's get started with this thing. We've been having some technical difficulties, and I'd started streaming the show, but then something got screwed up. So I don't know what the heck's going on. Possibly next week. But it was streaming for a little while. You got to see a little bit of the preamble, the hubbub beforehand. Let me go through and introduce today's panel. We've got the aforementioned Ethan Watermeyer.
Show.
We also have Oliver Camacho back with us.
Before we get off topic, I have to say that my profile is up on JDate, and nobody is interested in me.
Oh, no. What is JDate?
It's for attracting Jews.
Oh, really?
I love the Jews.
Jewish dating.
Yeah.
I guess the Jews don't love you.
I know. I think it's because they know I'm not Jewish.
That could be.
Oh, dear.
We also have Matthew Garrett.
Why is this night different than all other nights?
Next year, Oliver, in Jerusalem. You'll find somebody. We also have Matthew Garrett.
Hi there.
And Jennifer Good Cooper.
Hi, guys.
Hi. How are you?
It's so nice to break up all the sausage fest of the past two podcasts with a beautiful woman.
Yeah, that's true.
And Jennifer Goo, too.
Oh. Hilarious. Okay, let's get things started a little bit. San Francisco Opera. The Met has a new rival in operas at the movies. The San Francisco Opera on Tuesday announced its own plans to transmit operas to movie theaters using a system it says is superior to that of the Metropolitan Opera, which pioneered the practice in the United States last year. San Francisco said it would broadcast 6 operas a year starting in March and reach 200 screens, about the same number as the Met began with last season. The larger and busier Met now appears to have about 600 screens and transmits 8 productions a year. So, yeah, they're saying that we not only – I don't know why they think it's better. I mean, it's – I mean, well, the reason they say it's better is because it's more of a they're using the digital format that's used for that they use for Hollywood films when they're released into theaters. So, and I guess the Met uses projection systems, which they use for advertising in movie theaters. So, like the stuff that you see, the slides that go up before the movie. So, plus they're not doing them live; they're going to be edited and shown later on, so it's a little different than what the Met was doing, but it's interesting that they tried to make it seem like they were better than the Met, though. I mean, not that they aren't, but who cares? Just say you're putting your stuff out there.
$3 cheaper, too.
Yeah. Very exciting.
I like the fact that the Met is live, though. I think that adds an excitement to it. You know, people love live television shows because anything could happen. Look at Ashley Simpson. On Saturday Night Live. It's great, you know? Mm-hmm. Great TV.
That's true. When they streamed it into Memphis, there was some sort of a sound difficulty, and we got all orchestra, no voices.
Oh, wow.
It's like karaoke opera.
Yeah.
Do it yourself.
So that was exciting for a little while, and then everybody just left.
You should have stood up and sang, girl.
Yeah, that's...
Well, was it one of those... crazy operas like The Last Emperor or something like that? Was it something
no,
like you knew?
No, it was that sassy Eurotrash Bohème.
Oh, you know all the parts to Bohème. I know all the parts to Bohème.
Yeah, get out
and
there.
I should have done all the parts. I don't know what I was thinking.
Get out there and make it happen.
It could have been your big breakthrough. Can you imagine being discovered that way by standing up in the movie theater and singing over the soundtrack? And that's a great story.
Yeah.
That would be pretty funny. Get me that girl. She's famous, I tell you. She's famous.
That's how it works nowadays in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's so many opera entrepreneurs.
There are.
Connecting this all together, another one from Playbill Arts, and Covent Garden is heading for the movies, too. They're already on YouTube. It seems opera could become the hot new property on British movie screens as well. Even as San Francisco and the Met, La Scala and Glyndebourne are screening its productions in cinemas, news emerges that the Royal Opera House in London is preparing to follow suit. The Independent reported that Royal Opera has concluded an agreement with the Musicians Union allowing the recording of 14 productions annually for commercial exploitation. As opposed to blaxploitation, I guess. Sugar. With the right to screen 12 of these in movie theaters.
Nice.
Yeah. And while San Francisco purchased an installed state-of-the-art media studio, Covent Garden bought an entire DVD label, which we talked about of several episodes ago.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Matthew. What were you going to say?
I was just saying, it seems like the most difficult thing with all this is the union negotiations.
Yeah, well, that's always been the biggest thing as far as rebroadcasting of performances.
I mean, inventing the technology was easy compared to negotiating with the orchestra and with the stagehands and all
the chorus as well, too. The chorus is also a big part of it.
And the chorus. Meanwhile, the soloists get an extra $28 or something. And
yeah, and everybody goes on their merry way.
I think that Chicago Symphony Orchestra and Lyric Opera got back on the radio very recently, maybe as recently as this year, by just allowing them to not get their fees, you know, like by negotiating that, like the choristers and all those people just decide, well, we're not going to get paid for this, but, you know. And that's what we have to do, unfortunately. It's kind of sad, but yeah. We get paid, you know. It's not like they're, like, starving or anything like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you got to get it out there, otherwise nobody's going to see it. So what's the point in getting paid for something you're not going to get paid for the next year? Because nobody came, because nobody heard about anything, because nobody was able to sit at home and discover it.
Right.
So, very exciting.
I don't know. I mean, it's pretty important.
What don't you know?
Yourself. To protect, like, any of the singers that, you know, let's say it was a bad day vocally. And now all of America has, you know, has copies of it, basically, because anybody that wanted to pirate it could. And it was available to the masses. And at least you'd be getting paid for it if your voice crackled into, like, 3 or 4 at the end, your high note, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There should be a way to protect yourself so that you're not just, like, because it could screw with your career.
Well, I don't understand what you mean, though, that you don't.
I don't either.
Why you wouldn't want to have it broadcast because of that?
You would want to have it broadcast, but if you were protected financially, then it would help.
Well, you're getting like $100 when it's on. I mean, you're not getting much money.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the issues are with the union.
Well, it's just that they have to negotiate for lower fees, essentially, is what they do, because it's so expensive to pay them when they broadcast something on the radio.
Mm.
So that all of these things are being, in essence, probably reduced or removed somewhat. As far as the fees, I have to pay the musicians, the instrumentalists, and the chorus singers in order to get the stuff onto the radio because it's too expensive otherwise.
Right.
But everyone wants a little bonus if they're going to be recorded and broadcast and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the thing explodes into the next 3 tenors, people want to be protected, I guess, so that they
get a percentage.
Well, a lot of it is, too, they just want to get paid, yo. You know what I'm saying?
They all want our little piece.
Yeah, a little taste of the action, a little piece.
Yeah, but Janet,
I don't think that's fair to anything.
No, I do. But, I mean, yeah. I think another thing, too, is in order to expand things and think and invest in the future, sometimes you need to take a hit at the present, which is what they're doing with all these things now. So you're not going to get the money now, but maybe in the future, if the thing becomes big, they'll be able to get you back on the paying schedule you had before. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like starting a new business. You take a hit the first couple of years, hoping, and you invest in it, hoping that it pays off later on. So,
well, I'm just saying, but if they're gonna market my voice or whoever's voice, you know, if I'm on a broadcast that's gonna be seen 800 theaters nationwide, why shouldn't I get a little bit of a cut?
No, that's true. But the point was that the fees were probably so high before that they wouldn't have been able to do it because it would have been cost prohibitive.
Fair enough.
And that's what I'm saying, that you're taking a hit now, hoping for the future.
I'm taking PayPal donations.
I take PayPal donations on the website, operanow.blogspot.com.
If you guys think it's scary to sing at the Met, and then you, imagine doing a radio broadcast, that's even scarier. This is even taking it one step further. You got like 100,000 people watching you live if you're singing at the Met. You know, Mike Rice, when you debut, if you vomit all over the stage, they all see it.
I know.
On the front page of the Times. So, Jen, if I understand what you were saying before, I mean, yeah, it does open the...
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Matt? We lost you for a second.
And what Jen Good was saying, she was saying if you screw up, it can really screw with your career.
True.
But you know what? I just think it adds another. I do agree with you, and I was thinking about that while you were talking because I was thinking of asking you guys if you think people, all of a sudden singers, if it's going to create difficulties with performance anxiety, whatever. But I think it's really just an adjustment because if you think about it, it's just that opera has not commonly up till now been something that's been broadcast nationally in any kind of format. But if you look at professional sports or you look at live rock concerts or any of the award shows, I mean, those people are performing live. So
yeah,
it's just something I don't think any opera singer is used to.
And I think it'll be
something new to deal with.
I think that the risk factor actually makes it much more interesting for the audience. And I think the cream will rise to the top. You know, like I think that people won't be able to get away with, you know, bad performances if they know that they're going to have to really bring it. And who knows how competitive these broadcasts are going to become. I'm really glad that all these opera companies are throwing their hat in the ring. I mean, I'd love to see Chicago do the same thing. And then maybe it'll increase the quality of the productions and, you know, and just increase viewership altogether. So I think it's all good. It's all good, and, just like Jennifer Good.
And people, and I also think the cream will rise to the, you know, the top in terms of not just who maybe vocally is the best, but now that everybody's going to be able to see people up close, not to get on my box again, but it's going to come down to how do people look? Can they act at all? Are they communicating something believably to the audience? Those are the people that are going to be popular with the audiences, not just, you know, Park and Bark.
Good. I'm glad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. How else are we going to make opera appealing to young audiences, you know?
That's what I'm talking about.
And if there's an amazing singer, they will, you know, they will be heard, you know? Sure. I mean, plus there are not that many amazing voices. You have to admit, like, how many really amazing voices are there, like people who open their mouth and you just like you'll listen to hear them sing anything, you know, I mean, besides Paul Potts, of course
well, and ironically, and for me the best singers in the world right now are the people that not only can they sing but they're beautiful and they can act the hell out of everything.
That's just because you're very superficial. I think maybe that's why.
What's that?
Is it maybe because you're superficial?
Right, you're all about aesthetics and looks and not about the heart.
No, I'm saying that they are. No, I'm saying they're the best singers as well as the best actors in the world. The best operatic actors are the best voices. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you think that is the case?
For me, yeah.
Okay. Well, you're just saying that as a result of everything, they become everything.
No, the best singers in the world happen to also be the best operatic actors in the world.
You think that is the truth today?
I do. Yes.
Okay. All right.
I don't think that's the truth for everyone, sadly, but I find that I'm most moved by those who can communicate something to me and they aren't just Park and Bark people. And Ethan, that might be a little bit to do with the way that young singers are being educated now. I mean, most of us have had to go through acting training or workshop training, and they're encouraging that in, you know, in the programs, in conservatories. Do you disagree?
No, I totally agree.
So it is making it more interesting.
Just before we get off this topic, I just wanted to make sure that everybody noticed in this article about Covent Garden, near the end of it, they talk about having their own podcast too. And there are 10 podcasts currently available on their website, which I believe is competing with the Opera Now.
No, I've heard it. And I mean, what those are all of these companies, a lot of them, not all, but a lot of companies have things. And what they are, you know, they sit down and talk to so-and-so and to what's his face and who's
yeah, they got
tits,
they got Brent
like
Turple
that.
Talking about.
Well, I've got Oliver Camacho.
I know. I was going to say, can we ask Matthew Garrett, like, his insight on the role of the sailor?
Tell us about Apollo, Matthew Garrett.
Guys, I got to say, my connection's really bad. I've been missing most of this.
That's a shame.
I'll call you back.
Oh, that is a shame.
Let me call you back. We'll add you back in.
All right, thank you.
I guess we don't have Matthew Garrett talking about Taylor. Too good to be true.
No wonder it wasn't working.
Hello? God, he sounds just like Kevin. It's so weird.
No, I'm definitely not Kevin. Should I try talking louder?
Yeah, try talking louder. You're coming in okay, so.
Like Kevin. guys, I saw Cosi Fan Tutti at the Met a few years ago, and it was Nathan Gunn and another tenor, and they had to take their shirts off in one scene, and it was just laughable at how Nathan Gunn really looked nice, and the other guy really just didn't take good care of himself. and I had to cover up my smile as I'm watching this, thinking, if I were going to take my shirt off, I'd make sure that my torso was cut. Okay.
Oh hell yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, if this is going to be broadcast to theaters all over the place, I mean, God help you if you look bad with your shirt off.
That's terrible. Or if you're very porous, because, you know, the high definition picks up everything.
You know, and they got makeup and prosthetics. Yeah. You can add on muscles and
put a muscle suit on, like George Michael. Stuff a sock down the pants, whatever.
And, I was going to say, enhance your package.
Yeah, you got to. The ladies are watching.
Socks.
Yeah, and all we care about is big packages.
Exactly. That's what it says in all the
adult films. I think you're confusing gay guys with ladies.
That could be.
That's all I care about.
let's move on. The Metropolitan Opera is extending its populist mission. Apparently, they've become some type of socialist organization. Let's see. As of this month, the Metropolitan Opera is bringing its populist message to a new audience: school children. Last Saturday, the Met transmitted Romeo and Juliet live via satellite to high-def screens at five New York City public schools. 2,000 students and family members attended for free. On New Year's Day, they'll show Hansel and Gretel. Today, 2,500 students will spend their day at last day of school at the Met's first student open house, watching the final dress rehearsal of Hansel and Gretel. Wow, that's pretty interesting.
That's really cool.
Yeah, that's a nice thing. He's lowered the price of the cheapest seats to $15 and established the rush ticket, which you've heard about, in which seats that normally cost $100 are sold for $20. This school kid deal is interesting. I like that.
I heard that this production of Hansel and Gretel is not appropriate for children.
Yeah, we were talking about it a couple weeks ago. It's kind of inspired. The guy who did the design, he took his inspirations from the Pink Floyd's The Wall, or it's kind of very similar to that. I mean, I can't say specifically if that was what he was doing, but it's, you know, they're kind of messed up. And a friend of mine saw it recently, and just, you know, the backdrops and the scrims, they're just really, really, really freaky. They freaked her shit out, she said.
Wow. And so, it features Philip Langridge in drag as the witch. Is this the type of thing we want our kids to be exposed to, cross-dressing tenors?
Absolutely not. It's a disgraceful.
It's emasculating.
Where's Barney Frank? I mean, what's his name? Newt Gingrich.
Come on, they see all sorts of shit on TV.
I know. We're kidding.
They see worse things every day.
And 99% of these kids are just psyched to have a field trip.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, they're not in school. That's all that matters.
That's all they're going to care about. I mean, if you could hit like three kids and really touch their hearts.
I see a picture of a Langridge dressed as a woman. It's pretty freaky. He looks kind of like a cross between Barbara Bush and Dame Edna.
Can you send it to us?
I will.
Or post it?
I will.
Post that stuff.
It's pretty wild.
And the Charlotte Church picture again.
Yeah, put Charlotte Church back, of course.
Yeah, we love the Charlotte Church picture.
Oh, God, horrifying. I had nightmares for a week.
You know, speaking of the young ones, it seems the way to get opera more popular is to get our youngest and most virtuous opera singer pregnant. Awesome. Who would that be? Daniel Denise, I guess. Let's get her pregnant.
That'd be sweet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sign us up.
Let's call her up. Bonjour, Daniel.
Or Leah Wool.
Je m'appelle Etienne. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, where the hell is this picture? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is we're slipping
chance,
away.
Blew my chances away. That now, didn't you?
Possibly. I'm sorry. So we'll finish this story up. We're rambling here terribly. I'm sorry. Oh, the phone's ringing.
Hello?
This is a nightmare. It's a nightmare show.
A lot of trouble hearing.
Is that a caller or is that just your phone ring?
That's just a phone ring. It's a nightmare.
Woogie, woogie, woogie.
All right, next.
Yeah, moving on to... somebody should have just taken the lead there. I apologize.
Yeah, you always say you're going to edit this stuff out, and you never do.
This time I'm going to edit it out, yeah.
Just edit it out.
Okay, in 3, 2, makeover from the New York Times, Makeover scrambles city opera schedule. When the State Theater closes next year, the homeless New York City Opera will probably put on 4 stripped-down productions at other locations, Carnegie Hall possibly, the Beacon Theater, and other Lincoln Center halls. Now, this is huge. They're going to cut down – they're doing 4 shows only now next year. That's going to mean a lot of people out of work, a lot of people that we know, maybe even some of us, who are not getting – it's – that's huge. And I mean, not that I guess it's kind of just a difficult situation, but this is a big deal for singers out there, especially people who maybe live in New York. You know, they hire a lot of people, a lot of local people, too. This is very troubling. Very troubling.
It's troubling, but it has to happen. I mean, really, this is another example of taking a hit now to see something flourish later. I mean, it's time. It's time for it to happen.
Yeah. But it's just, I mean, because the company, they still, the union, all the union people still get paid their contract, but you know, they're singers, they're not paying, you know, no pay.
Right.
It's pretty insane.
How many shows do they usually do a season?
I think 12 now, but they used to do more even. And that's because that's been cut down. That's another problem.
What are the four shows they're going to put on? Does it say anywhere?
It doesn't say specifically. He was talking about maybe doing Mephistopheles. But he doesn't, it hasn't been finalized yet. They said it's probably going to be finalized sometime in end of January or February. So
possibly Rienzi.
Possibly.
Lesser known of Wagner opera.
Which they're doing like Glimmergast, aren't they? So maybe they're going to just steal that and bring it over.
And they have this picture of Mortier looking so smug in that picture. It's like, ha ha, you don't have a job.
I think it looks like, ooh, sorry.
Just like the French. Perhaps the singer should strike and riot the way the French youth did several years ago. What do you think about that, Matthew?
Well, is the theater going to be finished for the 9-10 season?
Hopefully. You know it's probably not.
I can't imagine. How do you repair an entire theater that quickly? Well, I hope it is. But look, I guess the timing is okay. They got more TA in there. They're going to change the whole guard. And I guess now's the time to do it.
And it's the time
when they come back, they'll be stronger than anyone's ever seen them. And it may be really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. I hope so. And they'll do live webcasts. Something.
For the record, it says here the 9-10 season is supposed to include Stravinsky's Rake's Progress, Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach, Janáček's Mokropoulos Case, Britten's Death in Venice, and Debussy's Pelléas and Mélisande.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Good reading there.
Way to read.
Yes. Maybe they can hire all the people that are out of work to like carry bricks like pyramids.
Yeah, they may have to.
And then they'll be done in a year.
Let my people go. So, but it's just, I mean, it does have to be done, I guess, but it's just the idea of all those people out of work is very troubling. You know, from 12 to 4.
Yeah.
Since they haven't hired me yet, this doesn't bother me at all.
Okay. Well, I guess good riddance, you're saying. It's a bad rubbish.
Oh, no. Just for the record, I'm not saying that.
No, that's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else is happening? Sting's John Dowland disc tops Billboard year-end classical chart for second year. For second year, Lorraine Hunt Libreson is fifth. That's kind of an odd story.
Love this story.
As it was in 2006, Songs from the Labyrinth, the disc of John Dowland lute songs performed by Sting, is the best-selling classical album of 2007. The top 10 are Appassionato by Yo-Yo Ma and others, Voice of the Violin, Joshua Bell, The Homecoming by crossover violinist Andre Rieu, Peter Lieberson's Neruda songs performed by Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, The Journey in the Labyrinth, the DVD. Wow, he's both the top CD and he's number 6 with his DVD as well. Very exciting. And everything else. I guess there's the Russian album by soprano Netrebko is number 10. That's the only other song.
The one singer,
yeah.
I mean, classical.
Operas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lorraine Hunt is on there.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson, yes.
Lorraine Hunt Lieberson.
Is anyone surprised that a Sting album is going to be number one? I'm not surprised. That seems to make sense to me.
I'm not either.
I mean, when it's all said and done, I'm sure the sales for this record, you know, are nowhere near like the sales for you know, Jamie Lynn Spears' records or something like that.
What?
So it's fine.
I don't know.
But I think it's a great record, and I'm very happy that he has taken the pride of place. And I'm glad that John Dowland is back, and he's here to stay, brother.
He is.
It is a good record.
If anybody had any doubts before, put them to rest. John Dowland is back.
We are now in the Renaissance.
For some reason, Sting's voice sounds, well, I don't know, maybe it just sounds oddly appropriate for that music.
It does. You know, I mean, stylistically, it's a little goofy.
It does.
But the color of his voice
really work.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really great about this story is that guess who's not in the top, whatever, 10? Paul Potts.
Bocelli.
Opera Babes, you know, Il Divo. I'm sure they sell a lot more than these records, but at least they're not considered to be classical records, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
What's the name? Wisteria? Helvi Wisteria or Haley something or other? I don't know.
I don't know.
All these
Did Sting arrange the songs?
I don't know. But he's playing along with somebody else.
No, yeah. I bet he arranged them.
There's not that much to be arranged here. He does a pretty straightforward presentation of them, and there's a lutenist, a very famous lutenist.
He stuck to original auditions.
Well, it's him. It's a lute, two lutes, or a lute and whatever. Nothing else.
He has a chorus in one of the songs, but it's pretty stripped down.
Oh, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Is it nice to have early music be at the forefront for once?
It is.
I miss early music.
Very early.
Stocking stuff.
It is a great. It's going to make a great stocking stuffer. Speaking of early music, Rare Gluck Opera gives Marvelous Rebirth at Met, is given a Marvelous Rebirth at the Met.
Segue.
Nice.
Considering that this is the country's premier opera house, the Met sure has some gaps in its rep. This is according to the Hollywood Reporter. Thanks, Hollywood Reporter, for pointing that out to us. Its current production of Gluck's 18th century opera, Iphigenie en Tauride, is, incredibly, its first appearance in about 90 years.
Wow.
Considering the high quality of the staging by Stephen Wadsworth, featuring Susan Graham and Placido Domingo, that lengthy gap is unlikely to recur. It's for you, Oliver. We know you love it.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm going to get in trouble with this one because I'm not supposed to be mean about these things, but I am.
Okay.
I listened to this broadcast on the radio, and, you know, I'm kind of an early music person, and this is very stylistically inappropriate, and like the singing was very, I don't know, monochromatic. It didn't really show a sense for this style of French, you know, and I thought it was actually kind of boring. And maybe it looks beautiful. They had this production, I believe the same production in Chicago, or they did a production of this in Chicago at the Lyric. And, you know, people are just told that this is, you know, cool, and like, you know, when the production's like really austere and like symbolic, like they're supposed to like it. And I know people who went to the show and like just did not like it, but you know, I'm sure they were giving standing ovations just to everybody else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was inappropriate? What about the
all the nudity and the four letter words that were inserted?
The drag queen.
I mean, this is reform operas are somewhere between Baroque and between, you know, classical. You know, the style Gluck is in that style. And I'm listening for the stylistic touches that makes it sound of that era. And I didn't hear any of them, you know. There should be a transparency in the tone quality. There should be a lightness in the orchestration or in the playing of the orchestra. And there should be a real emphasis on the declamation of the language. And it was just sung full vibrato all the time, you know, the orchestra wailing. And it just didn't feel from that era, you know. And it just was loud. It was bombastic for me. It's the word I want to use, but that's, well, okay, I used it. So, and, but I mean, the audience, you know, they're told that they're supposed to like this, and they, you know, they stand up and applaud. And I'm sure that people were bored. I'm sure of it.
You think so?
Yeah.
I didn't hear it. And I honestly don't know the opera. I just wonder, you're getting a little bit into an argument about historically informed performance practice versus
right, and this is very. I mean, it's 18th century, but what year is it? Is it late? Is it late Baroque? Is it early classical? Is it supposed to be something
that's
like?
It's not even late Baroque. I mean, but these operas are heavily influenced by French Baroque, super, super heavily influenced by it, like, you know, Rameau and stuff like that. And there are just things, things are done a certain way. Others, like I said, a transparency in the singing. And there's, I mean, what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of straight tone singing in it, you know, sure. And vibrato is used, you know, judiciously. And there's like, you know, little ornaments you do and stuff like that. But granted, Gluck, you're supposed to sing Gluck as it is on the page, but it comes from that, you know, and I didn't feel any of that. It didn't feel French at all to me, you know, it just felt very, you know, Germanic. It felt, you know, like it could have been Mozart, you know.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they decided to do a more, like you said, maybe they decided to do a more modern interpretation or modern or more romantic vocal interpretation stylistically, whatever.
They certainly did.
So people wouldn't be bored. Maybe they thought, well...
No, they brought in Domingo and Susan Graham, who are stars, and so they would go to see it, you know?
Yeah,
but well, if they're trying to revive, you know, this style of opera, they should at least, you know, give it a chance.
Be more true to it.
The conductor is the artistic...
In terms of the...
Mm-hmm. Over. The conductor is the artistic director, mostly Mozart.
Oh, yeah, Langley, Louis Langley.
Yeah.
Can we actually ask our listeners, anybody who's in New York or maybe who saw
we know people who are involved in it.
Just to write in or to call in or leave a comment on the book asking or saying how they felt about it. And to be honest, they could be anonymous if they want. You know, just,
yeah.
You know, did they enjoy it? Did they think it was something that was worth seeing again, you know, hearing again?
Please do it.
Call the hotline.
And you know, Oliver, it didn't get very good reviews. I don't know.
Oh, it didn't?
Not to knock the show. No, not really.
Oh.
It didn't get the best reviews.
Oh,
particularly,
good.
Sorry, Maestro, but particularly.
So would we rather
did not
see
get
a
the
production
best.
That is not performed as often and have it not be done historically correct, or would we rather not see it at all?
I'd rather see it in the context it should be in, personally, with the historical. The performance practice intact and everything.
I think we're too smart now, and there are too many people who are trained to do these things accurately to not do it. It's like doing Mozart with, or like doing Handel. I guess we're going to talk about something else, but I mean, there's so many things that we know better now, you know, just know better. And it's like they used to do Handel operas. They used to cut the da capo, and they used to cut the operas all up and like, you know, and we know now better that you can't do that. It just doesn't make sense anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And not that they really, like, you know, did something that dramatic to this opera, but they just didn't do it as cleanly and as stylistically as they could have. And I know that they're very, very smart people. I know Susan Graham is a very, very intelligent artist. And, you know, she probably was just asked to do it this way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I would never think of Domingo as a singer of this style of music. You know, granted, he can sing everything, but... maybe not this so much, you know?
Well, and that's what the reviews basically said.
Yeah, that's a fair cop.
You know, why did Domingo need to do this role? When there are other...
It is time
and
for
it,
me
it's
to,
actually a baritone role, isn't it?
It is time for me to reach backwards into our history, to embrace new roles that are classics, and to bring them to people in ways they have never been brought before. Thank you
that's
very
good.
Much.
Wow, thank you for joining us, Placido.
It was actually sounded more like Latka Gravis from Taxi.
Thank you very much.
So, and we're back streaming up on the website too, everybody. So if you're listening and watching, we got 3 viewers. How's it going? Welcome to the show, everybody. Did we lose you, Matthew, or are you still there listening?
No, I'm still here. My reception's really bad.
That's okay. Just focus for us. We're going to wind things down anyway soon. Let me see. It looks like we've done everything.
Have we really?
Yeah, everything that I wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
No, that's it.
Life as an opera singer?
No, not really. We'll save it for another time.
All
right.
What about that girl from Indiana who moved to New York? Did we hear from her yet?
Yeah, I have not yet heard back from her. I heard from a friend of hers. He actually won. My man John Roger that over. He was the first caller with the correct guess of last week's episode. We played A Little Town of Bethlehem, and the singer was Richard Tucker. Thanks for playing, John. As a prize, you're going to receive an autographed headshot of me, Michael Rice, the host and producer of Opera Now.
Tucker, I hardly know her.
Oh, I even, I gotta be faster with my sound effects. So, but yeah, I think this is probably going to be our year-end show. I don't know if we're going to be able to do one next week. So I just want to take a moment to, we've been doing this now for over a year, hard wow. to believe. And we've had some ups and downs, some strikes and gutters, man. But the show has abided, just like the dude. And I want to say to everybody out there who's listened and have been a fan of the show, thank you very much. I really do appreciate that. And also, I want to ask you to spread the word again. Tell a couple friends. We've kind of plateaued as far as listeners, and we haven't really had many new listeners in a long time, which is a problem, actually, that a lot of podcasts face now. You know, they were rising and rising and rising, and then they just kind of hit this ceiling, and they haven't been able to get beyond that. So get out there and spread the word. I'm going to be more regular with updates to the website, to the blog. I'm going to throw some video in every now and then to try to shake things up with the content, not just doing audio, but doing more writing and doing some video stuff even too that I'm going to put up. So, and if you do listen to the show, send me more emails and leave voicemails. I want to make the show more of a conversation between the audience and us, you know, over here behind the microphone talking. I'd even like to maybe even try getting a listener on as a co-host, maybe a couple times a month. If you're interested in that, send me an email. If you want to do any of this information, you can check us out at our website, operanow.blogspot.com, or can email us at operanow@gmail.com. And, of course, you can leave us a voicemail at our brand new voicemail line, which is 773-273-7904. So, everybody, I want to thank my panel today. We've got Ethan Watermeyer.
Thank you very much, and happy holidays, everyone.
Yes, Mr. Oliver Camacho.
You're welcome.
Mr. Matthew Garrett.
Thank you very much.
And the lovely and talented and alluring Jennifer Good.
Thank you, Michael Ray.
Thank you for coming on, everybody. Merry Christmas, happy holidays to everybody out there. Merry Christmas, happy Kwanzaa. I hope Hanukkah went well, Hanukkah. I am Michael Rice, and you've been listening to Opera Now.